that right?
Okay. So I just dropped that in my notes. It's actually, the term is zero anyway for everything we used it for. Oh, is it? Okay. I do not need the minus sign. Oh, okay. Oh, fine. Okay. All right. I take it back. I'm perfectly happy to accept I got a minus sign wrong. But if I didn't, even better. Okay. Okay, so we derived the equations for a perfect fluid in GR. And then we looked at two special cases. And so I'll just remind you what the special cases were. So one was CDM, or cold dark matter. That's just a gas of particles, and the particles have no thermal velocities. So you just think of them as a cloud of particles, each particle sitting at rest in some expanding universe. So they're kind of co-moving with the expansion. And then you perturb the density of this cloud, and the particles start to clump. So that's called cold dark matter. It has zero pressure, and this leads you to delta dot plus, I think, did I call it theta? Delta H, if you remember, was the perturbation to the trace of the spatial metric. So we had something like Hij is A squared Fij plus 2 phi Fij. Let's write it this way, 1 plus 2 phi. So this phi perturbation is basically a conformal perturbation to the spatial metric, right? I take the FRW spatial metric, and I just multiply it by some function of space and time, some small perturbation. That's what phi is. So phi is actually the conformal perturbation. And then I had some other thing, which was di dj. Something? Chi? No, what was it called? Gamma. Thank you. Okay. So, and then we said, and so delta H is equal to the trace part of this. So I guess I get 6 phi from here. I trace this guy. I ignore the A squared factor. I get... and I ignore the 1, of course. So it's really this part. And plus box co-moving gamma. Okay, so that was delta H. I think that's right. And then we had the second equation was theta dot was minus A dot over A theta. And we're in conformal time units, so N naught was equal to A. And So the metric, the full metric, was equal to my a squared times minus dt squared plus hij. Okay, so theta dot was this. That's it. Okay, yeah. Oh, you're right. You are perfectly right. Yes. Okay. It's a bit annoying. Sorry. I should have wrote it like that. Because hij already has an a squared in it. So this is really minus a squared. Well, let's put the a squared in there. Minus dt squared. Plus, and then it's this stuff, Fij. Gamma dx dx. So that looks more sensible now. So basically, everything in here, we've pulled out the A factor from everything. Okay, for CDM, as I described, the velocity perturbation, and actually this theta dot is the divergence of the velocity of the CDM. This velocity perturbation just decays away because this equation implies that theta equals some function of x over A. I mean, that's the solution of that equation. Right? It's a first-order differential equation. And that's the solution. It has an arbitrary integration constant for each x. So that just tells you theta decays like 1 over A. If you set it non-zero, it will damp away. So if it's 0 initially, it's going to be 0 for all times. And then we had just this equation, basically the change in the metric is causing the density perturbation in the CDM to grow or decline. And then the second case was radiation. P is one-third rho. And I did mention the subtle point that for photons to behave like a perfect fluid, you actually need some scattering. Okay, and so basically the scattering introduces a mean free path. So the photons are moving around with some mean free path. And this perfect fluid description is actually valid as long as you consider wavelengths much longer than the mean free path. Okay, so the photons are scattering off the electrons, and I've got some wavelength which is much larger than the scattering length. Then it's okay to treat the photons as an isotropic fluid. Because if you had some streaming photons, okay, they would actually encounter electrons and scatter and isotropize. So this description is valid on wavelengths lambda much greater than the mean free path. If you go to short wavelengths in a photon fluid, you will find a large viscosity term, which basically will damp out short wavelength perturbations because the photons just stream away. And so a wave does not survive. It just damps away. That's called Landau damping, by the way. Landau damping is if you set up a wave in a gas of photons and let the gas go, they just stream across the wave peaks and the wave is gone. That's a viscous regime called Landau damping. So if we treat radiation as a perfect fluid, isotropic stresses only, then P is one-third rho, and then we obtained delta dot is minus two-thirds H dot, and the extra one-sixth there compared to, let me write it in the same way as the equation above. So there's a minus four-thirds theta, and then a minus two-thirds delta H dot. The extra one-sixth is due to the redshifting of the photons as the
spatial metric changes compared to the CDM, which doesn't redshift. The particles' masses remain the same. And then we have theta dot equals minus 1/4 box co-moving delta. So you already see a kind of peculiar feature of CDM, which is there are no gradients that appear in these equations anywhere. Okay, providing I express dV as theta, there's no gradient. And these equations are what are called ultra-local. There are no gradients. And so what that means is if you take the universe at some time and you just measure these quantities, delta and dV, and you let it go, then each point is completely independent of any other point. There's no communication between different points in the universe. Okay, so it's a little surprising at first sight, but that's the way CDM works in linear perturbation theory. So you can essentially just imagine any feature you put in delta, say I put a square wave down or a Gaussian down in delta, and I just let it go, well, it'll just preserve exactly the same spatial shape and just grow in amplitude. That's all that happens. Whereas with the radiation, this box term here causes oscillations. So this connects different spatial points, and now you get waves, and so that has a completely different behavior. Right, so as I described last time, these are two equations for three unknowns, right? Two first order equations for three unknowns, delta, theta, and delta H. And so we can't solve. We need another equation. And the same for this one. So we need one more equation. And that's not surprising, because these equations just tell you about the flow of energy and momentum. They don't tell you about gravity. They don't tell you how the gravitational field is changing. So obviously, we're going to get that out of the Einstein equations. And the equation we need, well, there are many different equations you can use, but one of them you can use is equation 44 in Bardeen, which I need to write out what it is, but essentially this comes from the perturbed Einstein equations, and so that equation in synchronous gauge where alpha is zero just looks like this: k dot over m naught plus 2hk equals 4 pi g epsilon plus 3 pi. Now, by the way, this equation is again, doesn't have any gradients in it. It's a little bit surprising. Does this remind you of anything, this equation, the rho plus 3 times the pressure? You know the Friedman equation. Well, we had the Friedman equation, a dot over a squared is 8 pi g over 3, rho minus k over a squared. Okay, that's a normal Friedman equation. Now, there's another equation I can get from this, and then I have energy conservation, 3h p plus rho. Right? So those were the two basic equations describing the evolution of rho and a, because p is a function of rho. So actually, there are only two variables here, rho and a, and these are two equations for them. So that's a complete set of equations. But if I take these equations, I can derive another equation, which is minus 4 pi g a rho plus 3 p. Have you seen that equation as well? So basically, if you do that, if you notice that k here is a constant, you multiply through by a squared and differentiate, you're going to kill the k. And what you'll end up with is exactly this equation. So this is called the Ray-Chowdhury equation. And what it essentially tells you that in GR, the gravitating energy is rho plus 3p. It's not rho. See, because you could derive this equation using Newtonian mechanics. If I just said I've got a ball of radius r, and it's got some mass inside here. Okay, so in Newtonian gravity, I can neglect everything outside this radius r, right? If it's spherically symmetric. So homogeneous universe is certainly spherically symmetric around every point. So I can draw some radius r, throw away everything outside here, and because it has zero gravitational field inside that shell. And now I just work out the motion of a point on the surface of the sphere. It'll be r double dot is minus gm over r squared, where m is the mass inside r. And what is the mass? The mass is just 4 pi over 3 rho times r. Actually, do I need a 4 pi over 3 there? Rho r cubed. Which should be exactly this. There, this is the matter. Is there a 3 in there? Never deviate from your lecture notes, because you're... so we have 3 there. And rho dot is... Anyone see where the 3 is going? I know this works. let's just do this. A dot squared equals 8 pi g over 3 rho a squared minus k. Differentiate it, I'll get 2 a double dot a. A dot. And then here I'll get 4 pi, I'll get 8 pi g over 3. And then I will get rho dot, which is minus 3 a dot over a, p plus rho. And then I'll have it my a squared, and then I have a plus 2 a dot over a rho a squared. Yeah, so there is a 3. Okay. So basically, these two terms combine into minus a dot over a rho plus 3p a squared, and the... Cancel this with this is AA dot, divide through, and I'll get that, and I'll, yeah. Okay, so there is a 3 here. Okay. So Newton was right. Okay. So in other words, the gravitating density of matter is really rho plus 3p. not just rho, in Einstein's theory of gravity. And this is essentially what we see here. This equation, k, if you remember, is the perturbation to h, right? K is the expansion rate, the full k. And this little k is just the perturbation to the expansion rate. And so this equation is just directly measuring the effect of rho plus p 3p, the perturbation in rho plus 3p, on the expansion rate. In fact, you can derive that equation just by perturbing this equation. Right. I'll leave that as an exercise. Okay? So exercise 3. Try to derive this just by considering FRW. Okay, so just derive it in FRW. Of course, you can't justify the fact there are no gradients. You just ignored all the gradients. But nevertheless, this equation should be true. Pi, if you remember, is delta p. So E was E naught plus epsilon, and p was p naught plus pi. Okay, that is 3.1. Okay. I told you Bardeen was the one thing he was not good at is choosing notation. Okay. Apart from that, he was brilliant. Okay. Everyone has to have their flaws. Okay. His was bad notation. Right. So we have this equation. And we also had the equation from last time that this little k was minus h dot over 2a. Okay. We worked that out. And so we can put this equation into that one, and I'll just give you the answer. So obviously I'm going to get two derivatives of h, so I get this equation. And remember, this delta here is defined to be epsilon over E naught. So that, and this should be a delta H. That's a delta H, that's a delta H. Okay, so now at last we have three equations for three unknowns. And the gravitational one, as I've emphasized, is a kind of trivial one. It's basically saying that the Hubble constant changes due to changes in the energy density. Okay, so now we're going to solve these equations in these special cases. So let's take CDM only with theta equals 0. So we take a cold dark matter universe. We perturb the density, but not the velocity of the dark matter. And first thing to do is actually to work out the background. So I should just be careful that in this case I was using proper time, right? This isn't proper time, whereas here I'm using conformal time. So just this is all proper time. Okay, so don't get confused about that. Proper time is when you pick n naught to be 1. Conformal time is when n naught is a. Okay, so this is also conformal time. Right, so we have
Let's first work out the background. Okay, so here we have H squared. Let's take a flat universe. H squared is, in fact, let me put it, let's put it up here. So a flat FRW universe. The background is just H squared is 8 pi g over 3 E naught. You've got pressure equals 0. So this equation here, if p is 0, this equation tells you that rho goes like 1 over a cubed. Okay, the solution of that equation is that E naught is proportional to 1 over a cubed. You can see that if I take the time derivative of this, I'm going to get minus 3 a dot over a times 1 over e cubed. So it'll satisfy the energy equation. And so we have here that h squared is a dot over a squared, 1 over a squared, because this is my n naught squared. And that's equal to 8 pi g over 3 E naught. And that's proportional to 1 over a cubed. And so what I have here is a dot squared multiplied through the a to the fourth is proportional to a. And so that tells me that a dot is proportional to a to the 1/2. And that tells me that a is proportional to the time squared. And again, this is conformal time. If you want to go back to physical time, to proper time, dt proper is just a times dt. And so t proper is integral a of t dt, where this is conformal time. If that goes like t squared, this will be proportional to t cubed. Okay, and so then the scale factor, which goes like t squared, is proportional to t proper to the 2/3 power. And that's probably what you saw before for a matter-dominated universe in proper time. Okay, it just happens it's much easier for the perturbations to work in conformal time. Okay, so that's actually all that we will need in these various equations. Now we can do, is there a rather neat trick we can do? If we know a goes like t squared, then we see a dot over a is 2 over t. And then I can figure out what e naught is in here. So what I get, if I multiply this through by a squared, I will get 8 pi g over 3 e naught a squared is equal to a dot over a squared, which is 4 over t squared. Okay, and that's nice because that's what kind of occurs here. The e naught a squared occurs in that equation. So I'll just leave this equation up here for now so that we can see it. And we're going to substitute in various things to get this this equation. The first thing we can use, so if theta equals 0, then I have h dot equal to minus 2 delta dot. That was my energy conservation equation for delta. So that's good because it means I can eliminate H in this equation and just write this as solely an equation for delta. Sorry, that's delta H dot. Okay, so now I get this equation that delta double dot plus A dot over A delta dot equals minus 8 pi G, actually plus 8 pi G because I had a minus sign.
in relating delta H to delta. So I get plus 8 pi g. And actually, I divide by 2 because there's a factor of 2 here. So it's 4 pi g, 1 plus 3 cs squared, and then E naught a squared delta. But the E naught a squared, so for CDM, when cs squared is 0, then 4 pi g E naught a squared is equal to 6 over t squared. So that becomes, so let's see, for CDM, delta double dot plus 2 over t delta dot, because a dot over a is 2 over t, equals 6 over t squared delta. And that's an easy equation to solve because it's homogeneous in T. So you just try power law solutions. So delta proportional to T to the N. And if you try that, it just substitute in there, you get an equation for N. And you can solve it. N is 2 or minus 3. And so the general solution for delta is that delta of t and x is equal to an arbitrary function of x times t squared plus another arbitrary function of x times t to the minus 3. This is the growing mode, and that's the decaying mode. Okay, so this growing mode is why we exist. Okay, because if you look at the cosmic microwave background 300,000 years after the Big Bang, the density perturbations are very small. They're about, delta is about 10 to the minus 5 in the microwave background. Okay, somehow that delta managed to grow to much bigger than 1 today, because we're sitting here and we have deltas much bigger than 1. And the way it grew is through this. Okay? And you ask, where did that come from? It came from the right-hand side here, the fact this is positive. And that is self-gravity. That's the fact that when you perturb the universe, it creates a negative gravitational potential that sucks in more matter. Okay, so this is all due to self-gravity. And so what you can do is estimate the growth factor during matter domination. Okay, so the universe, the early universe was dominated by radiation. And this derivation is all wrong. But the late universe, when matter came to dominate, this derivation is basically correct. Okay, so roughly speaking, you can just say this effect started when the universe became dominated by matter. And that happened when the scale factor of the universe, so the scale factor equal matter radiation, equal density of matter radiation, you can figure out just by taking the density of radiation today and the density of matter today and scale them back. The radiation goes like 1 over a to the fourth. The matter goes like 1 over a cubed. And at some point, they cross. And that when that happens is 2.5 times 10 to the 4. Sorry, other way around. The scale factor today over the scale factor at equality equal matter radiation density is 2.5 times 10 to the 4 omega matter today times this little h squared. Little h is the Hubble constant in units of 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So basically, this factor is a few thousand. Um, And you see this growing mode is growing. Remember, t squared is proportional to A. So basically, the growth in the density perturbations is just proportional to the scale factor. But the scale factor is increased by a few thousand in the matter-dominated era. So that makes it plausible that the density variations we see today are a thousand or a few thousand times bigger than they were at matter radiation equality. Still doesn't quite explain the 1 part in 10,000 you got from 1 part in 100,000 growing to 1 today. And there's some extra little factors of 2 and 3 and pi and so on, which explain the whole thing. So basically, quantitatively, this works very, very well. There's also an important logarithm, which I'm going to derive now. So I said during the radiation era this doesn't work. You don't get growth of perturbations. It's not quite true. In the radiation era, you get logarithmic growth of perturbations. And we'll see that next. Okay, are there any questions about that? No? Okay, so now let's do cold dark matter in the radiation era. Cold dark matter plus radiation. So we want to consider that has both dark matter and radiation, and we're going to look at it in the radiation era. So to sort of show you why there's a radiation era, just consider the density. And when I'm doing the background, I'm just going to use conventional notation, not Bardeen's. Okay? So the density is a function of A. The radiation goes like a to the minus 4. So that's the density of radiation. And the density of CDM goes like a to the minus 3. Goes like a to the minus 3, right? And here we are today with the dark matter dominating over the radiation. But if we trace the universe back in scale factor, this is the point where they cross. They cross here, where at A equality over A today is equal to the density of radiation today divided by the density of at CDM today. Okay, so because they just scale in this way, you can just take their ratio, and that's proportional to A, so you can figure out when they crossed in the past, and that's that number over there. And if you're worried about these factors, these are kind of obvious factors, because the critical density, well, I won't even get into it, but if you, those omega H squared is basically telling you what CDM density is today. If you know the universe is flat, you know the Hubble constant, and you know omega, which is the ratio of the density to the critical density, then you can get CDM density. Okay, so the derivation I've given for CDM is valid here. We just ignore the radiation. But let's now look in this era, where the radiation is completely dominant over the dark matter. What happens to the dark matter perturbations? Do they do anything? So it turns out they grow logarithmically in time. It's a more subtle growth. Now, we're in the radiation era. And so things actually depend on wavelength now. We've got to worry about those grad squared terms in the equations, okay, which we didn't have to worry about with CDM. So now we worry about the grad squared. And so in fact, what we should do is Fourier transform the equations to get rid of the grad squared
And so what I say is that delta of T and X is equal to the sum over Fourier modes, delta sub K of T e to the I K dot X.
Okay, and you might replace this by an integral. I like to work with discrete sums, and so I'm really imagining a box of the universe, and in that box I have all the possible modes. So I've got some box, for example, with periodic boundary conditions. I've got all the modes, and here's my density perturbations. But you can work with an integral if you prefer. We'll discuss that more a little bit, maybe tomorrow. Okay, so now I have to relate the So now we have an important concept, which is adiabaticity, or adiabatic perturbations. Now, this is a jargon used in cosmology. A perturbation is adiabatic if the following is true. Okay? If, when I think about this curve, the local state of matter is defined by some point on this curve, right? At long wavelengths. So adiabaticity only holds at very long wavelengths. So we're kind of thinking about a perturbation in the universe that's so long wavelength that locally I can think about this as an FRW universe, right? Because the wavelength is enormous. It'll be much bigger than the Hubble radius, for example. So at long wavelengths, locally I can think about this as an FRW universe. I say the perturbation is adiabatic if the ratio of dark matter to radiation is exactly what it would have been in an FRW universe. Okay? In the universe you're in. So what you're imagining is that some local physics determined this ratio. It might have been particle physics or a phase transition or something. Something fixed the ratio of radiation to CDM at one particular time. Okay? And then at all future times, that ratio was fixed. Now, you say the perturbation is adiabatic if you lie at one point on this curve, even with the perturbation. Okay? So the way you implement this is you look at the CDM and radiation equations. So the CDM we had delta, let me now put a subscript on, delta C. So this was equal to, I've forgotten the theta factors. Lost my notes. Then there was a theta term here. What's the theta term in this equation? Sorry, I'm not consistent. This is a theta. Is it minus theta? I just wrote these down. You should have them. What's the coefficient there? Just minus theta. Okay, and then we have the radiation one, which is delta gamma, let's call that, equal to minus 2/3 delta H dot minus 4/3 theta And then I have theta dot equals minus 1/4 grad co-moving, or box co-moving theta. So if you stare at these equations, imagine there was no velocities, so your fluids are not moving with respect to each other or to the background universe. So just ignore these terms. Then you see the way it works is that when you change the metric, so that's a dot. When you change the metric, these two things change in fixed ratio. So what you see from here is that delta C dot minus 3/4 delta gamma dot equals 0 if theta can be ignored. If this is theta gamma and that's theta C, of course. If the thetas can be ignored. And so that tells you that delta C is equal to 3/4 delta gamma plus a constant. Now, if the constant is 0, that is the adiabatic mode. So the adiabatic perturbation mode is one adiabatic perturbation have delta C equals 3/4 delta gamma. And in fact, that's rather, you can just read that off from this curve. You see, because if rho C is proportional to a to the minus 3, and rho gamma is proportional to a to the minus 4, and if all you're doing is pushing yourself up and down that curve, right, then delta rho C would be minus 3 delta a to the minus 4, and delta rho gamma would be, well, let's divide by rho C. Delta rho C over rho C, which is delta C, I get to divide by this, and so I get delta A over A. Whereas delta rho gamma over rho gamma, which is delta gamma, is minus 4 delta A over A. And so that gives me the 3/4 as well. Okay, so adiabatic perturbations have this 3/4 in the relationship between delta C and delta gamma. So in fact, now I can use this equation. And I'm going to use it on long wavelengths. Right. So this equation, if you remember, the left-hand side came from using this formula, delta A dot is minus 2 delta C dot. The right-hand side comes from everything in the universe, all the matter in the universe. So actually, it's a sum of two terms. It's this term for delta gamma, and this would be E naught gamma, the density, the background density in the photons. And then I'd have another term for the CDM. And here I'd get 0. This is E naught C, A squared delta C. So when I have both photons and CDM, I need both of these terms. Now, in the radiation era, E naught C is much less than E naught gamma. That's the meaning of the radiation era. We're way up here. And you see, we have this formula that delta C and delta gamma are the same magnitude. So I can just ignore this term, right? This term becomes negligible. So in fact, what dominates in the radiation era is the adiabatic perturbation to the radiation density. which is in fixed ratio to the CDM perturbation. So I can substitute that in here. Let us first work out E naught in the radiation era. So in the radiation era, so we have the A dot over A squared is equal to 8 pi g over 3 E naught A squared, because I'm in conformal time. E naught goes like 1 over A to the fourth for radiation, so that's proportional to A to the minus 2. And that means that A goes like T in conformal time in the radiation era. Okay, but now I can do this trick. If I know A goes like T, I just put it back in this equation, and that'll give me E naught A squared. Okay, so I get that 8 pi g over 3 E naught A squared equals 1 over T squared in the radiation era. And so the first equation here, let's call that star. So star becomes delta C double dot plus 1 over T delta C dot. And then I've got 4 pi g times 2, because 3 CS squared is a third for the radiation. So I've got equals 8 pi g E naught gamma A squared, delta gamma, but delta gamma is 4/3 delta C. Okay, and this combination here from this equation is 3 over T squared. And so what I get is delta C double dot plus 1 over T delta C dot equals 4 over T squared delta C. I did that right. And again, we can solve this by power laws. And the solution is that delta C is equal to an arbitrary function of x times T squared plus another arbitrary function of x times T to the minus 2. And so again, the growing mode goes like T squared, okay, goes like conformal time squared. But this time, that's actually the square of the scale factor, not the scale factor. Okay, so we've now solved for the long wavelength behavior of the density perturbations, of adiabatic perturbations. Adiabatic ones, as I described, are ones where the local composition of the universe is the same from place to place. You don't perturb the relative abundance of CDM and radiation. And, okay, so this is valid for long wavelengths. And that is for lambda much bigger than the Hubble radius. It's also interesting to look what happens on short wavelengths. So on short wavelengths, basically what happens is I'll set up my perturbation, okay, in the CDM and the radiation. When the wavelength is very long, essentially there's no oscillations that are happening, right? The universe is expanding. This is all in co-moving coordinates. The whole thing is just growing. But at a certain point in time, essentially when light has traveled one wavelength. This perturbation realizes it's a wave, okay, and the oscillation will begin. So that, in other words, the period of these oscillations is so long that they have to wait for the Hubble radius to catch up with the wavelength before they oscillate. When they begin to oscillate, the delta gamma oscillates. That's because of the gradient term in the equation. So remember, we derived. So if we neglect the h dot term, we derived that delta gamma double dot was 1/3 delta gamma. And so if I Fourier transform, that becomes k squared over 3 delta gamma with a minus sign. And so the photon, or the radiation density, is really a harmonic oscillator for every k. And it will oscillate with a period is 1 over k. All right, the frequency is k, the period is 1 over k. When it oscillates, this means it just averages to zero. Okay, anything with a restoring force proportional to it is just going to oscillate around zero. So this is the way the wavelengths behave in time. So in space, they look like this. This is delta gamma as a function of space. As a function of time, delta gamma sub k, so that's some particular Fourier mode, as a function of time. Well, when it's long wavelength, it's in that regime. That's at early times. It's much bigger than this. So this is where k is much less than 1 over t. That's the only scale in the problem is t. And in that regime, it grows like t squared, as we derived. But when you get to k to times of order 1 over k, in other words, times equal to the wavelength of the mode, then it just starts to oscillate, and it'll average to zero. Now, if it averages to zero, then this equation becomes rather simple, because as I argued, that term is negligible. The CDM term is negligible, because the density is so small. This term, if delta gamma is zero, then you can drop that term too. And so the entire equation just reduces to this, delta C double dot plus 1 over t delta C is zero. So that's a really easy equation to solve, and the two solutions of it, actually, the solutions of this equation, and I'll just leave that as an exercise, that delta C is an arbitrary function of x. Sorry, there's a dot here. Arbitrary function of x times the logarithm of t plus a constant. And that's the logarithmic growth I was telling you about. Okay, so it's really kind of a trivial thing. It's just saying that you perturb this expanding universe, you ignore the source term completely in the Einstein equations. But in a radiation universe, nevertheless, delta C grows like a logarithm. That's called the Mazaros effect. And again, we wouldn't exist if it wasn't for this effect, okay? Because that logarithm contributes about a factor of 3 in the density perturbation growth. And that's actually important. Yeah? Yes, ignoring this term, yes. Yeah, it's a good point. Essentially, the way it works is the following. That's a good point. We'll have a homogeneous left-hand side in the radiation era, right? In order for a term to matter
on the right-hand side, it has to be some number over t squared. Okay? You can kind of see that with the homogeneous equation, that if this term is a very small number over t squared, because the scale of these terms, you have power law, sort of rough, the scale of these terms is delta c over t squared, because I have two derivatives. If this number is small compared to delta c over t squared, you can ignore it. Okay, that's the kind of rule of thumb. So it's based on the relative importance of these terms. Put it another way. Let's imagine we ignore this term. Then we solve the equation. We find we get a logarithm. Now I go and calculate the size of these individual terms. And I'll find that they're equal to delta c over t squared. Because when I differentiate the log twice, it's a over t squared, right? Which is, well, it's up to the log. It's 1 over t squared times delta. And now I say, well, how big was this term compared to those terms? Well, it's much smaller than 1 over t squared delta, just because this, the density, you see, this quantity is 1 over t squared, right? That quantity is 1 over t squared from the Friedman equations, because a dot over a squared is what is equal to this. So the CDM has to be much less than that in the radiation era. So it's down by a factor of a. So essentially, because this one is scaling like we can also see it from here. You see, e naught a squared goes as 1 over t squared. As e naught gamma goes like 1 over a to the fourth, and then there's an a squared, and a is t. Whereas this guy here is actually, that's 1 over a cubed, and so this is 1 over t. So what I've actually got in that second term is some number over t times delta c. And I'm working in a regime where, you know, this term is much smaller than that. T is small, so 1 over t squared is big. And so this is negligible. But you can solve all these equations. In fact, you can even solve them analytically. It's not. I'm just taking shortcuts. Okay, so we've basically seen the two big causes of growth in the universe. One is in the radiation era, where our little density perturbation in CDM grew by a logarithm. And the second one, and that's not quite right. If we plot this delta C, okay, so now delta C doesn't have any oscillatory terms in its equations. It's going to grow like T squared when the mode we're considering is still outside the horizon. So it hasn't started oscillating. So these two just grow in proportion. And then when the radiation starts oscillating, the CDM is going to go over to this log. Now it'll sit here. This is all the radiation era. And it's growing very slowly, like a log. And then we'll get to the matter era, and it'll start growing again like t squared in the matter era. Okay, so that's basically the history of the perturbation mode. This growth outside the horizon is a little bit of an artifact. It's gauge dependent, turns out, and it's not sort of you don't really grow from zero to a perturbation. So we'll discuss that a little. So the whole issue about exactly what this means is important, and we'll deal with that next lecture. But this stuff inside the horizon is real physical growth. Okay, so I think I just wanted to do one more thing before we end today. And that is to talk. I've introduced k, the wavelength, and again, terrible notation. This k has nothing to do with the other k. This is the Fourier mode's wave number. Okay, And so Bardeen, again, picked his choices unwisely. There are three different Ks. There's a capital K, there's a small K, there's a Fourier mode K. So in the final few minutes, let me just talk about the power spectrum of perturbations. And so, as I said, if we think about some quantity like delta, some density perturbation, which depends on x, I want to study its time evolution. It's very convenient to Fourier transform, because then all the gradients in the equations turn into numbers, turn into k and k squared and so on. So delta of x, I want to Fourier transform, and so I'm going to write it this way, e to the I k dot x. And basically what happens when you do this is that the partial differential equations, which are the Einstein equations, for delta, which involve time and space derivatives, now just become ordinary differential equations for delta k, because just time matters. Okay, so you look at it Fourier mode by Fourier mode, and each Fourier mode just obeys an ordinary differential equation in T. And ordinary differential equations are much easier to solve than partial differential equations. So that's an advantage. Now let's just say, what does this mean? So I think about this as having a box of size L. And I'm going to put periodic boundary conditions. The box is irrelevant to anything real. It's just a calculational device. Okay, so I want to take the size of the box much bigger than anything I'm actually interested in. Okay. There's just a mathematical device, but it's a nice device to use, because then it means everything you deal with is discrete and exact. So the volume is L cubed. And with periodic boundary conditions, your wave numbers have to be 2 pi n1, well, have to be n1, n2, n3, right? So they are just integers multiplied by 2 pi over L. And that's in order that this exponential here is single-valued as you go around the box. So it's periodic. So the function is periodic. Now, we're going to consider a statistical ensemble of delta sub k's. Which is to say that when I draw these amplitudes, I'll be picking it from some statistical distribution. And the simplest case, it'll be a Gaussian. So delta k will be a Gaussian random variable with mean 0 and some variance. And so the way we write that is delta k, expectation value of delta k prime. And that's a classical expectation value, right? This is just a classical statistical distribution of delta k's. Expectation value of them will be proportional to a delta function that is imposed by translation invariance. Okay, so if your statistical ensemble is invariant under shifting space, then the two momenta here, the only correlations which are allowed are those between equal and opposite momenta. Okay, that's something you can prove. Basically, you can prove that the spatial correlation function is the Fourier transform of this power spectrum, and it will only be a function of the distance between the two points if the correlation between the Fourier modes is
non-zero only for equal and opposite momenta. Now, this power spectrum here, in fact, should further be constrained. It's only a function of the magnitude of the wave number. Okay? So basically, this is imposed by homogeneity, which means invariance under translations. And this is imposed by isotropy. There should be no special direction in this statistical ensemble. So, for example, any of the theories we have which generate these perturbations do have this character, like inflation or ekbarotic universe or anything else anybody has dreamed up actually produces a statistical ensemble which is homogeneous and isotropic. So just characterized by a power spectrum. Some other properties you should be aware of. If delta of x is real, okay, that's a real quantity, this delta of x, then it imposes, this imposes that delta sub k star is delta sub minus k. Okay, so obviously if I complex conjugate this, nothing should change. But if I complex conjugate this guy, it looks like it changes. But what happens is that I complex conjugate this, and then this changes to minus ikx. But if this is true, then all I get is the summation with k changed to minus k, and that's equal, because k is a dummy, index. So another way of saying that expectation value is the expectation value for amplitude squared of the Fourier modes is equal to P of k. Okay, so P of k is just giving you the variance of delta k squared, or the variance of delta k. And then I'll leave it as an exercise. Show that the expectation value, so this is the two-point correlation function, is equal to the Fourier transform of the power spectrum. And also show that the summation of a k is equal to, or maybe can be, yeah. In the continuum approximation, the summation of a k can be replaced by the volume of the box times integral d3k over 2 pi cubed. So I'll leave that for you to think about this afternoon. So even though I always like to formulate things in a box, at the end of the day, you're probably going to end up calculating this sum, and if you want to calculate the sum, you can approximate it by an integral. This approximation works when the wavelengths you're considering are short compared to the size of the box. Okay, are there any questions about that? When is the class this afternoon? 2:30? Okay.